Kenneth Moore continues the story of popular music in England during King Edward's short but memorable reign. He also examines the development across the Atlantic of a particular style of music that was for the first time purely North American.
As the 20th century got underway, and the long march began from ragtime to rock and roll, so the balance of power in the popular music world swayed back and forth across the Atlantic Ocean. Generally, the songs the British liked to sing best were their own, where the lyrics referred to familiar places and the melodies had about them an indefinably yet unmistakably local touch. I live in Trafalgar Square, Burlington Bertie from Bow knocked him in the old Kent Road. And it's odd how so very often the sentiments expressed in these songs were sad, melancholy, very often downright tear-jerking. Stanley Holloway puts it down to a national tendency to musical crocodile tears.
They're all very lugubrious, the songs in those days. Very sad they were. Always very sad. Everyone's always crying or dying. Or both. The English public have always loved sad songs. You know, oh, Genevieve, my Genevieve, the time may come, the days may go. You know, always very sad. They still do. They still love them. You see, the songs today, even the popular ones, are all about, I'll never cry again till you come back or something, or I'll never smile again, you know.
Well, you could almost hear those tears splashing down Edwardian cheeks at the sound of that one. But, of course, there was the other side of the coin, too. The boisterous Saturday night out feeling of so many of the great hit songs of the early years of this century. The theory that a taste for sentimental tears is built into the English temperament is true enough. The Little Nell syndrome, if you like. But what places the lyric of this next song in its historical context, bang in the middle of Pride of the Empire, is the line, "Oh, what a happy land."
Go down the Strand, let's all go down the Strand. I'll be leader, you can march behind. Come with me and see what we can find. Let's all go down the Strand, oh what a happy land. That's the place for fun and noise, all among the girls and boys. So let's all go down the Strand, all together. Let's all go down the Strand, have a banana. Let's all go down the Strand. I'll be leader, you can march behind. Come with me and see what we can find. Let's all go down the Strand, have a banana. Oh, what a happy land. For fun and joys, all among the girls and boys, so let's all go down the Strand.
Could anything be more typically London than that song? Or this next one? When you hear this one, it seems to express the very soul of Cockney London. All kinds of images spring to mind. Of Pearly Kings, Happy Hampstead, bank holiday, hooplas, saloon bars on a foggy night, cobbled streets and the gas lamps, yellowing shine. Not so much a song about London, so much as London itself expressed in song.
Come, have some port wine with me down at the old Bull and Bush. down at the old bull and bush. Bush, bush.
Florrie Ford's Down at the Old Bull and Bush, one of the most durable expressions in the music of the working classes of Edwardian England. The only trouble is that the song is American, written in 1903 by one of America's most successful writers. Who was he? Well, we can't be sure, because the composer of Down at the Old Bull and Bush used an assumed name. And to complicate matters, he had a songwriting brother who also used the same assumed name. The name was Von Tiltzer. And the American Oscar-winning lyricist Leo Robin confesses that he's as bewildered about the Von Tiltzers as they seem to be themselves.
The songwriters used to take various names. Why he took that, I don't know, but he had a brother, too. I forget his brother's name. And he was a very fine writer in his own right.
Well, we can straighten you out, Mr. Robin. The Tiltzers' real name was Gum. And as they used to say, it didn't stick. They took their mother's maiden name of Tiltzer. They added the Von for what they called a bit of class and settled down to writing songs like this one. If a typically English song like that turns out to have been written in America by two men with a German surname, it begins to look as though tracing the history of our music is not quite as simple as it looks. If we want a popular song so unmistakably English that it couldn't possibly have come from anywhere else, we have to turn to the summer of 1902, when the most English of all hit songs appeared, appropriately enough, in the year a new monarch came to the throne. The British Empire had had a seeming eternity of Victoria, more than 60 years of her, so it was no wonder that most of her subjects couldn't remember any other reigning monarch. And what was a bit more awkward, none of the nation's dignitaries could remember how to crown anybody.
At the coronation, the Archbishop of Canterbury blundered sadly, adjuring the king to give his special protection to widowers, and then, with painful consciousness, substituting widows. The essence to prompt him only seemed to muddle matters further. Worse was to come. At the close of the oration, the accompanying bishops pulled different ways in an effort to raise him to his seat, and but for the timely assistance of the king, he would have been dragged off his feet by the Bishop of Winchester. When it was time to employ the holy oil, the Dean of Westminster narrowly escaped pouring the contents of the chalice over the queen, and after the ceremony, everyone tried to break through the file of grenadier guards drawn up to stop people leaving before the royal procession. The Duchess of Devonshire pressed on, missed her footing, and rolled over on her back, her coronet flying off and striking the stalls with a loud crash.
Edward Elgar wrote Land of Hope and Glory in 1902 and was the first English composer of international stature to emerge since Purcell 200 years before. But was Sir Edward's music any more English than, say, this?
I'm in a nice bit of trouble, I confess. Somebody with me has had a game. I should by now be a proud and happy bride, but I've still got to keep lifting the name. I was proposed to by Obadiah Binks in a very gentlemanly way. Lent him all my money so that he could buy me home, and punctually at 12 o'clock today, there was I, waiting at the church, waiting at the church, waiting at the church, when I found that he'd left me in the lurch. Lord, how it did upset me. All at once, he sent me round a note. Here's the very note, this is what he wrote. Can't get away to marry you today. My wife won't let me.
There was I, waiting at the church, waiting at the church, waiting at the church, when I found she left me in the lurch. Lord, how it did upset me. All at once, he sent me round the note. Here's the very note, and this is what he wrote.
Waiting at the Church turned up in 1906, the year that artists like Vesta Victoria, who made the song as famous as it made her, joined an organization destined before long to bring about some alarming situations in popular music. But before we take a look at that hornet's nest, what about the rigid class distinctions of Edwardian society? How did they affect performers? How did they make their presence felt in the songs those performers sang? Clearly, there were two sides to the coin. The American lyricist Irving Caesar remembers the very song which describes the problems of the class war.
English music hall stars that come over here sing, sir. John took me home to see his mother, his mother, his mother. And when he introduced us to each other, I thought she'd da-dum-da-dum-da-dum. She put me through a cross-examination. I thought I would die with indignation. Then she shook her head, looked at me and said, poor John. Oh, what great songs. Poor John, oh, great songs.
A lucky girl, I know, 'cause I'm engaged, but still somehow I don't think so. John, that's the name of my fiancé, you see. There's no mistake, he's very fond of me. He took me out for walks, and oh, he was so nice. Always used to kiss me on the same place twice. Often in the park, we would sit and spoon, and I was oh so happy till the other afternoon. John took me round to see his mother, his mother, his mother. And while he introduced us to each other, she weighed up everything that I had on. She put me through a cross-examination. I fairly boiled with aggravation. Then she shook her head, looked at me and said, poor John, poor John.
Poor John, poor lady friend. Poor everybody so hidebound by class distinctions that the music hall laughed at. But the old order changeth. 1901, Marconi transmits the first radio signal across the Atlantic. 1903, Wright brothers echo a lyric to be written by the Gershwin brothers 30 years later and prove that man can fly. 1904, opening of the Daily Bioscope, Britain's first permanent cinema. 1905, first Rolls-Royce car. 1906, Bakerloo and Piccadilly Underground open to the public. And yet in the midst of all this progress, both the British and Americans allowed an Austro-Hungarian ex-bandmaster to put the clock back. The great foreign invasion took place in 1907, and it was heralded by these irresistible strains.
Though I say not what I may not let you hear, yet the swaying dance is saying, love me, dear. Every touch of fingers tells me what I know. As for you, your feet. Follow the chime of the time of the waltz's beat. Oh, come away, away, music is playing. Linger not, vainly delaying. Take your partner's choice is spread. Will you please now dance with me? For the night of the ball will go by, and the dawn will be cold in the sky. Let us capture our joys as they fly. Soon will they fade and die. There's a charm in the thrill of the strings, like the beat of the doves with their wings. Then away, no delay, let us dance while we may, for our pleasure will end with a day.
Perhaps no show in modern history caused the sensation The Merry Widow did. His composer was a man called Franz Lehár. Before The Widow, he was unknown. After it, he was world famous. The man who brought The Widow to London was, inevitably, George Edwards, and at first Lehár took exception to everything about the London production. Only when he began to hear his lush harmonies, augmented by the chink of gold coin, did he suddenly realize what a wonderfully musical race the English were, and begin to display the much-vaunted Habsburg charm, as Bernard Grun remembers.
He was flabbergasted when he saw the first rehearsal. He didn't like anything. He didn't like Lily Elsie. She was too young, he said. He didn't like Joseph Coyne. He had no voice, he said. He hated most of all good old George Graves, the great comedian George Graves, who played, of course, the ambassador. Because George Graves was too funny for him. He didn't like, Lehár didn't like laughter in the theater. He thought it takes the audience's attention away from the music. But most of all, Lehár hated the orchestra. He thought 28 people in the orchestra are not enough for his score. He insisted on 38. Later, he gave in. And he, of course, when the tremendous success came, and the success came straight away during the first night, he loved everything, and he left a week later full of delight, and he loved suddenly England. He didn't mind the weather at all. Actually, it was the king, King Edward VII, when he came to one of the first performances that made it so tremendously popular, and the king came again and again. I would say, next to the Fledermaus, it is the greatest masterpiece in this particular genre.
Beautiful. The actress who originally played the widow in London, Lily Elsie, soon became the toast of England. Winston Churchill saw her in the part several times and said, "It's inconceivable that anyone wished to see anyone but Lily Elsie in the part." And as her face appeared on chocolate boxes, biscuit tins, newspapers and magazine advertisements, as middle-class ladies insisted on wearing the widow's wide-brimmed hat, even though its size made getting out of a carriage an impossibility, while all this furore was going on, it's interesting to see what kind of a social world Edwardian London really was. Well, it was a world still lit with gas lamps, when a seat in the stalls was yours for half a guinea, and on boat race night they used to clear all the bottles and glasses off the tables at the bar of the Empire Theatre. One of the very slightly tipsy young gentlemen wandering the town appears to have been Sir Compton Mackenzie.
An Oxford friend of mine was celebrating his 21st birthday. First at the Café Royal with a wonderful dinner for 11 of his friends, from which we went on to occupy 2 boxes at the Empire. I'd had a good deal of champagne, and I got it into my head that the great Adeline Genet, prima ballerina of the Empire, was not dancing herself, but standing perfectly still on the stage while the theatre was dancing around her. This upset my notions of the way a ballerina ought to behave, and taking off my tailcoat, I threw it down into the stalls, where it enveloped an elderly gentleman sitting there gazing at Genet through his opera glasses. I hear now one of the commissionaires saying as he brought back my coat, "Now, sir, you've had a wonderful evening. Don't go and spoil it."
When the last wisp of the dancer's melody had wafted away on the night air, back to reality, where a good supper cost a quid. George Edwards was paying his chorus girls 35 shillings a week at the time, and even Lily Elsie only got £10 a week as the widow, although later Edwards doubled it. And after all, money was very, very important if you wanted a bit of that Edwardian gaiety that posterity is always hearing about. We're told that Edwardian nightlife was a pretty racy affair, but at least one person who missed the fun because he couldn't afford the price of a ticket was P.G. Woodhouse.
As I remember it, they used to turn out the lights at a place like the Savoy pretty early, about 12 o'clock or something. I think nightlife was very mild in those days. And of course, I had no money. I couldn't go in for it much.
Well, P.G. Woodhouse wasn't the only one who was finding it difficult to make ends meet. And that brings us to the group which included artists like Vesta Victoria, who began to fight against the injustices of their profession. One of the most distinguished variety theatres in England then was the House of Commons, and there, after the general election of 1906, a new bill was passed recognising a worker's right to withhold his labour. Within weeks, the Variety Artists Federation was formed, and the country had a strike on its hands. Arenas, which had echoed for years to the lusty strains of a musical humour, sometimes sentimental, sometimes ribald, suddenly died away.
Telegraph, 23rd of January, 1907. War has been declared between those who control and those who provide the entertainment given in the music halls of the country. The demands of the performers are as follows. 1. that at all halls working two shows a night, matinees shall be paid 1/12th salary for each matinee. Two, that no artist be transferred from one theatre to another without his or her consent. Three, that time shall not be varied after Monday without the artist's consent. Four, that all disputes be referred to a board of arbitration. Five, no commission to be stopped where artists are booked direct. Six, no bias to be shown against any artist who has taken part in this movement.
The music hall strike caught the public imagination because the music hall itself was the great central source of entertainment for the whole nation. The opposition of the management against the artists was led by Sir Oswald Stowell, not a performer, by the way, but an impresario.
Miss Lloyd's utterances are so grossly exaggerated that it is to be hoped they are due to an innate partiality for dramatic effect rather than to that truth which constitutes her value as an artist.
Hold your hand down, naughty boy. Hold your hand down, naughty boy. Last night in the pale moonlight I saw you, I saw you with a nice girl in the park. You were strolling full of joy, and you told her you never kissed a girl before. Hold your hand down, naughty boy.
The Daily Telegraph, January the 28th. The end of the strike is not as near as some of the more enthusiastic members of the Alliance believe. February the 5th. The music hall strike is practically at an end. There is little doubt that the action of the stars must lead to the collapse of the strike movement. February the 12th. The Night of Stars entertainment last night, organized by the National Music Hall Alliance at the Scala Theatre, turned out to be more of a night without stars. Miss Mary Lloyd viewed the performance from a box. February the 15th, the music hall strike has now entered a new phase. All pickets were withdrawn from the 22 halls affected by the strike.
Finally, in June 1907, a government arbitrator decided in favor of the artists, and the crisis was over. But still, life remained difficult for the rank-and-file performers. And it wasn't always just the money that attracted people into the business, as Bud Flanagan reveals.
People become performers for all kinds of funny reasons. But I'll tell you what it was that first put me into the theatre. Fish and chips. Yes, fish and chips. My father used to have a fish and chip shop in the East End. And I'm talking now about the early 1900s. And this shop was just around the corner to the old Cambridge Music Hall in Commercial Street. When the turns had finished their act, they used to ask for a butler's stout and a bag of fish and chips. And that was where I came in, running backwards and forwards from the shop with the pro suppers in my arms. By the time I was 10 years old, I became a call boy at the Cambridge. And one of the things I can remember about that time is the big music hall strike. That was in 1906, of course. But that was called to get the artists better terms. In those days, the managements could make an artist do as many shows a week as they wanted. But the strike back in 1906 changed all that.
Bud Flanagan's recollections of early music hall days being a bit of a contrast with what was going on at the Coliseum, it was no wonder that young hopefuls like Bud started to look a bit further afield for their salvation.
When I was 13, I decided to go to America myself. Really, I was America mad. I didn't have any money, so I walked to Southampton, bussed in front of a theatre queue to raise the money for a night's lodging, and next day went to sea as a ship's electrician. At least that was what I was supposed to be. But it wasn't what the chief electrician called me.
And when Bud Flanagan got to New York, what did he find there in the way of music? On the surface, the same mixture that was flourishing in Britain. A bit of sentiment, for instance, melodiously expressed.
Just a weary for you. All the time of feeling blue. Wishing for you, wondering when you'll be coming home again. Restless. Don't know what to do, just a weary for you.
Morning comes, the birds awake. Used to sing so for your sake, but there's sadness in the notes that come trilling from their throats. Seem to feel your absence too, just a weary.
And to balance the sentiment, the American equivalent of Cockney boisterousness, by our old friend Harry Gum, alias von Tiltzer, whose hit of 1905 has retained its popularity to this very day. And in that same year, 1905, a last flourish from the dying veteran of the banks of the Wabash, Paul Dresser. By now, Dresser had developed two very unfortunate habits. One was giving all his money away, and the other was crying like a baby every time he performed one of his own songs. It was generally believed that he was crying because he was thinking about the money, but whatever the reason, in 1905, he bequeathed to America one of those songs so perfectly suited to the combined vocal efforts of any four barbers you care to name.
Well, they called her Frivolous Sam, a peculiar sort of a gal, with a heart that was mellow, an all-round good fellow was my old pal. Your trouble, sorrows and care, she was always willing to share. A wild sort of devil, but dead on the level, that's my gal
But still, the interchange between English and American music was considerable, and all American audiences were familiar with the art of the music hall giants, including Irving Caesar.
Most of them are furnaces, very few volcanoes. A volcano doesn't necessarily have to be loud. Harry Lauder wasn't loud, but he was a volcano. There was something about the... If my father, who, though not an immigrant, had only been in this country, say, 10 or 15 years, if he and his more recently arrived friends could go to a Harry Lauder presentation and come away and buy the records and want the records and want to make the records part of their experience, their cultural experience, that proves something, doesn't it?
You stop your tickling joke. Stop your tickling joke. Then he make me laugh, say happy, or you'll make me choke. Oh, we should stop your nonsense and look at all the folk. Will you stop your tickling, 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 I wish you'd stop your nonsense and look at all the folk. Will you stop your tickling, tickling,
tickling? Irving Caesar, who remembers Sir Harry Lauder slaying American audiences, was one of a rising generation of American writers who were, in time, to eclipse the Austro-Hungarian operetta and the British music hall song. Another one of these young men was the composer J. Fred Coots.
I looked around for a stepping stone, and I found out that every year they had what they call a Friar's Frolic, which was a theatrical show made up of all members of the club and composed. So I found out that this actor, Eddie Dowling, was going to be the producer, and he also was going to write the lyrics. So I asked my friend Jack Gleason, who was the dean. He wasn't the abbot, he was the dean. I said, I'd like to meet Eddie Dowling because I'd like to be able to write the music for the Friar's Frolic. He said, well, I'll have him up here, Freddie, and he liked me. So, hello, paging Eddie Dowling. Eddie, Jack Leeson, will you come up to my office, please? Come up. He says, Eddie, this is a new member of ours, a young composer. This is J. Fred Coots. Mr. Dowling, I said, hello, Mr. Dowling. He said, hello, Freddie. And he says, Freddie would like to write the music for the Friar's Frolic. He says, well, I'd like to very much give him consideration, but I've already asked Victor Herbert and Rudolf Frimmel. So he says, it's just out of the question. I said, Mr. Dowling, would you do this? In the event that neither gentleman are able to produce the music, would you consider me? She said, sure. So, the next thing you know, Victor Herbert was signed to do Naughty Marietta, and he wasn't able to do anything. Rudolf Frimmel fell in love with a Chinese girl and ran off to Shanghai with her. So, that's how I got the chance to do it.
Good luck. Of course, Rudolf Frimmel and Victor Herbert were two of the most talented operetta composers of the era. But in the case of Herbert, there were limits to his ability. Herbert was a true international. Born Ireland, educated Germany, professional start England, success America. Irving Caesar remembers at least one thing Herbert couldn't do.
Victor Herbert was an atrocious pianist. Good Lord, you'd think he was playing with his fists. You understand? But he was a cellist. He was a great cellist.
And also, of course, a brilliant ballad writer. If the travels of Bud Flanagan, the struggles of Fred Coutts, and the piano playing of Victor Herbert all in their own ways reflect the stage life from the performer's point of view, there was also the way the ordinary member of the public saw it. Although describing Groucho Marx as an ordinary anything is probably a very unwise thing to do.
I used to live in a street called 93rd Street, and there was a girl there that I was stuck on. She was almost 15 years old, and I used to go out every morning and buy bread for my mother. And I used to get the stale bread because it was 4 cents, and the regular bread was 5 cents. So in no time at all, about 4 months, I had saved 70 cents. And I was stuck on Annie Berger. She had a great pair of legs, and I used to watch her walk upstairs. She lived on the floor above us. So one day, after I had the 70 cents, I said, why don't I take you to the theater? I had it all figured out. 10 cent car fare for two, 10 cents for car fare coming back, and 50 cents for two seats in the third gallery. Now, when we got to the theater, it was Hammerstein's Victoria Theater, there was a fellow selling sauerkraut candy in front of the theater, and it was a nickel bag. And she said, gee, I'd love to have some of that sauerkraut candy. Well, I only had 10 cents left by this time. So I bought her a bag of this candy. Now, we're sitting in the gallery so high, you couldn't even see the actors. And she starts eating the sauerkraut candy. And I can hear her, and I can't hear the actors on the stage. And I could have killed her. I thought she'd offer me a piece. But she didn't. So when the show was over, by this time, she consumed all the candy. And we got outside, and I said, Annie, it was cold. It was real cold. It had been snowing all that day. I said, look, you had sauerkraut candy, didn't you, in the theater? You never offered me a piece of the candy, did you? Now, I only have 5 cents left, and we got to go all the way to 93rd Street. Now, look, I care a great deal about you, but I don't want to walk to 93rd Street. I said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll toss a coin up, this nickel that I had left, and you holler heads or tails. She hollered heads, it came down tails, and she walked home. I didn't see her again for 10 years.